Hey, welcome to Culture at a Crossroads. I'm your host, David Mann, and we are jumping back into another great episode where we can explore the intersection of faith and culture in Canada. That's what the show is all about. And we're so thankful for the people that are willing to come on and to share from their perspectives and to answer questions that Christians may have. And so that's what this is about, helping you understand culture and to do so in a way that could help you in your faith in following Jesus. Depending on when you listen to this, I do want to wish you a happy Easter. And if you are someone who would consider yourself a Christian, I say he is risen and you say he's risen indeed, right? And we're going to miss that, some of us that can't be in person. Well, on that note, Culture at a Crossroads is in association with the Ultimate Questions podcast. And for the past couple of episodes, John Topping, the apologist, he's been considering the legitimacy of Jesus' death and resurrection. Really hearty stuff to unpack, but he does so in a way that you can understand. And the episodes are always less than 20 minutes, so he's not as long-winded as I am. You can head to the Ultimate Questions podcast, just search that and you'll find it, no problem. This week on Culture at a Crossroads, we take a deep dive into the Celtic music world. And we're going to do that with fiddlers Natalie McMaster and Danelle Leahy. The husband-wife duo are a couple of Canada's best, and maybe the world's best, for that matter. They also have 7 kids, and each of them seems to be following in their footsteps just a little bit. But how did they get here, and how do they balance it all together? Faith, family, farming, and fiddling? We're going to find out. Natalie McMaster and Danelle Leahy, great to have you guys on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So really interested in the sort of the journey that God has taken you guys on in your life, and wondered if we could just start with that, your deep Catholic faith. Maybe we'll start with ladies first. Natalie, how did that kind of become something of importance for you in your life?
Very naturally, actually. I grew up in a Catholic home, my mom and dad, my 2 brothers, and we lived what was shown to us. And that was, love your neighbor as yourself and practice your faith. Practice meaning attend Mass and follow the guidelines of the church. And that was just what we were taught to do. We never questioned it. My mom and dad are incredibly charitable people, and their charity is not forced. It's very natural. And they learned that from their parents. I often hear stories about my grandmother who would take in drunks off the road and, let them live with her for a couple of weeks. Mom remembers growing up with that, and mom in turn passed that on. She would always take care of the lonely and the suffering and addicts and things like that, in different ways. And my dad, same thing. He was always helping people. And I think those are the fruits of their faith. And for me, when I got into my teenage years, into going into college, and those days when you're outside of your home and you're living on your own, your intellect forms and forms with regards to your faith, and you question, why are we doing this and what am I doing and what's this about? And I never once lost my faith. In fact, I claimed it as my own when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I practiced it vigorously and became on fire with it and discovered the value in it for myself. And it's been that way ever since.
What did claiming it as your own entail?
Continuing on with what I grew up with, but thinking about it instead and wondering and pondering and seeing, is this a value for, I think for most people, it's like, oh, do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? But when you live it and you fall, at times to learn a lesson, you have to fall. And, I discovered just through living my life that the lessons of what I grew up with our faith, were good and true and beautiful and something that I wanted to live by because I could see the goodness coming from them.
Oh, very, very cool. Very neat. And Danelle, what about yourself? How did the role of God play in your life?
It's kind of similar. I'm not sure if people know it. My mom is also from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And so her upbringing was very similar to that of Natalie's parents. My dad is from Ontario, Duro, Ontario. And faith was just, once again, something, it was just like eating, going to do chores on the farm. Our faith, we said prayers, we went to Mass, It also wasn't questioned in our family. There's 11 of us, and I laugh with a lot of brothers and sisters. You're challenged to keep up, be it in sports or in music or in goodness or whatever. So I think we kind of had this team around us that you always went with the team, and our team lived our faith. And I'm the oldest boy, but I have four older sisters. It was something that just always was.
Would you say you could see almost Jesus in some of your family and wanting to aspire to be like them?
Well, let's not go too far.
You know, it was one of those things that wasn't really even analyzed. It was just, it was. You know, we didn't think about having to get up and do chores. You just got up and did chores. We didn't think about saying prayers. It was a thing that was like putting your socks on. You said your prayers, you brushed your teeth, you said grace before meals, you prayed the rosary, you went to mass. It was just kind of, and through all of this, we lived and laughed. And I don't know, I don't know how else to describe it then. It was just one of these things that you never questioned, you never thought of questioning it. That's what we did. That's what we were.
An expression of gratitude, kind of the life that you'd been given.
Absolutely. I mean, another thing, we lived on a farm. There were 11 of us. We lived out in the country, and we didn't have a television, so we made our own fun. We never missed out on anything, but we kind of lived within our 100 acres, and I don't know how different things were at our place, but we certainly laughed and loved and lived.
No, that's really beautiful. Danelle, would you say that you had a bit of an experience like your wife in terms of going off the farm at any point of your life and having to claim it as your own, or it's been more or less, you know, you're in the same area that you grew up in and you just continued the course?
I continued the course, but no, I went to university and I lived, you know, that was your first time out of the house was living at university. But, you know, we traveled as a family. One of the big things for us was, you know, always getting to Mass on Sunday. And it was amazing. You could be any corner of the earth and you'd find a Mass and it wouldn't conflict with our shows. It was, or our travel. I remember one time we didn't think we were going to get it. We were flying through the Minnesota St. Paul airport.
And they have a chapel.
They have a chapel. So we did everything to get to Mass on Saturday night because we were flying Sunday and it didn't work out. And we're like, oh my gosh, it's going to be like the first time. And we're going in and we found Catholic Mass at whatever it was, 11 o'clock, and our flight was like at 12:15, so we got to Mass. But you have the responsibility. Mom was always the one that would tell us, okay, we have to put our clocks ahead, we have to put our clocks back, or today's it's Good Friday today, the days of obligation. Mom was the one that logged that, so you didn't have to think about it. And then all of a sudden you're living by yourself and you're like, oh my gosh, I better figure this out and do it myself. But I'd still just call Mom. you take the responsibility. It's almost being proud of the fact that you're thrilled that you have that responsibility. And you have a direction, yeah, yeah. So I was always happy living my faith, especially when I was on my own.
Oh, thanks for sharing that. Well, I want to pick up on this a little bit more later on, but sticking in your early days as children, when did the musical influence sort of grab a hold of you more than just something that was a part of your family, but something that you wanted to pursue in even a career kind of form?
For me, it was probably my first years of college. When I started the fiddle at age 9, I knew I would always play. In fact, I think I was playing for 3 weeks, and my older brother did a mock interview with me, and I was pretending I was a famous fiddler and had, you know, been playing for decades. And it came naturally to me, and it just felt right. And I knew deep down, and this is a great feeling for people learning something, whether it be math or some school project or music, if you know deep down that you can do it, even though you're not doing it, it's like, oh, I can't do this. What? How do you do that? Oh, I can't get it. There's this sense and awareness deep down that you know you can. You just have to put the time into it where you know you can do it. So I think that's what fed a lot of my progression to you know, to advance. And so through the years, I always knew I would play, and I was eager for it, even though I hated practicing. I always tell my kids, our kids, I said, it's okay to not like practicing. That's okay. The hardest part is getting the fiddle in your hand. But when I decided to go to Teachers College in 1991, at that time, it wasn't even a thought that I would play the fiddle for a living. I mean, there was no female fiddler that I knew of that didn't have another job. You know, there was no male fiddler that I knew of that didn't have another job. If they were playing fiddle music, it was on weekends, holidays, summers, you know, festival, or, you know, that when you had time off. So yeah, I didn't think it was an option. So I thought, I'll be a teacher. I love kids, and it will allow me to continue music in summers, weekends, holidays, evenings, that sort of thing. So I went to Teachers College, and in about my second year, I thought, maybe I'll only be a substitute teacher, because the fiddling was becoming so busy, I hardly had time to go to school. And then by my third year, I started going part-time, and I finished through correspondence. And I knew then, I was probably about 21 probably, I thought, I'm not going to be teaching. And then it was all I could do just to finish it. So I did get my Bachelor of Education and never used it. Ironically, we homeschool.
How did the busyness come about in the demand of you fiddling for work at that time?
Because I grew up in Cape Breton, there was tons of places for a young person to play. And for me, who was the daughter of Minnie Beaton, a well-known step dancer, and the niece of Buddy McMaster, and for someone who was very young, it was very easy to be asked to play at all these functions. I'd be going every night of the week through the summer. And and that's a big deal, which I appreciate even more now, because for our children, there's no place for them to play unless it's our stage. But there's not a lot of functions. You might get a St. Patrick's Day event or something, but that's once a year or something twice a year. So it's hard. You have to make your own. But in Cape Breton, it was very easy that way, because there's so many traditional functions that go on with music.
And then blazing your own trail, that it did become something full time, and there was such a demand to see someone like yourself. What do you attribute that to?
Well, that's interesting. You know, through the years, it just kind of went to other places. I remember when I was 14 and I got a call to play at Expo 86. And I was so excited. It was out in Vancouver. And for 2 weeks, we played 3 shows a day. And I was as excited, honest to God, I thought you gave me the Academy Award or the biggest thing you could get, like to play far away. You know, it was such a big deal. And then when I was 16, I decided to do my first recording. It was a cassette tape. And from there, I started going down to the States a lot. I guess people, I don't know, it circulated around some kind of way. People from Cape Breton who lived in the States would pick up a copy when they were home in the summer, and then they'd take it back to wherever they lived. And before you know it, I got into kind of a folk music circle in America. And that was going well. There was, you know, every couple of months. I remember a big gig for me was getting the Greenfields of America tour. I think it was in grade 12. I would have been 17. And had to leave school for 2 weeks and go on tour. It was a big deal. And then from there, you know, I got into other avenues. The Celtic Masters of the Folk Violin, or the Masters of the Folk Violin tour came after that. I was probably 19. These were incredible opportunities that got my foot in the door to go back to a lot of these places as a solo act in the next coming years. Then over in Scotland and Ireland, we got a booking agent, and things were going well in Canada and the States. So I had some management then, and we started going overseas a lot, and just things kind of grew and grew.
Incredible. What about you, Danelle? How did the idea of doing music for work, how did that kind of come about and come to fruition beyond sticking to the farm?
Well, it's funny. My parents were both musical. They had a dance band back when I was a little lad, and they played like Natalie would describe. They had jobs. We were farmers. And on weekends, they would play at local dances, weddings, round dances. There'd be hotels, and that's where a lot of live music was. And I remember Mom and Dad telling me that they were booked into one place for 3.5 years. Every weekend. It's quite a gig. So it was natural they started me playing. I remember starting when I was 3. And then there weren't a lot of opportunities for us to play. We couldn't play in the hotels. So Dad and Mom entered me in fiddling contests. There were fiddling contests throughout Ontario. And there'd be one every weekend in the summertime. And my sisters were in the step dancing contests. And those were the places that we were able to perform. And I remember being a little lad, I'd win the youngest fiddler of, you know, the youngest class was 12 and under. Well, I'd be 4 years old. And I would win the youngest fiddler for a long time. And then, you know, eventually you'd start do a little bit better. And so I did quite well in them. And then we started getting, because there were so many of us, we started getting asked to perform at do our little guest number at the fiddle contests. And that became festivals, and it became, then there were fall fairs, and the fall fairs would hire us to play for a show and a dance after. It'd be like in the arena, and there'd be show seating set up, and then there'd be a half hour break, and they'd clear the dance floor and set up tables, and there'd be a dance. And it was sort of, you know, something we just kind of did. I remember then, somewhat like Natalie, we were getting asked to play so many places, entertaining, that I didn't have time for the contests anymore. We were booked up. And I remember the one year I went in one contest because I was just busy all the time. And Mom was telling me there one time, not too long ago, that nobody's children played back then. She said to see children play, people were shocked because we were like the only ones around that were playing. And now nowadays, you know, there's all those television shows, talent shows, and children's shows, and we see children playing all over the place. But Mom said
that was playing well.
And playing well. That was such a novelty. Anyway, I ended up doing the Leahy thing, Leahy family, and went to Germany for 6 months with my family, playing at a theme park. And we didn't have management or agents or anything like that. And basically, the way our shows got booked was someone would call and say, could you play this Saturday night? We'd say, sure, and you'd mark it on the calendar. Well, being away for 6 months, we didn't answer the phone. There were no cell phones or emails or anything. So when we came back from Germany, it was like we had no bookings. And it was like for the first time in such a long time. And what do we do? And so I said, well, I better go to school. And when I went to school, to university, that's when I really got the drive for it, because I really realized I wanted to play music and I had time to practice. People talk about being busy at university. I found university was when I had the most time, the free time. I didn't have chores and farm and family and commitments. And so I practiced. And I remember coming home at Thanksgiving that first year and my family being shocked how well I was playing. I never noticed it because I was just literally playing hours a day. And then I realized that when you don't live at home, you have to buy the groceries that go in the fridge. And I realized that it was time for me to start, you know, I needed money. We didn't need money at home. Never needed money for a thing. And then when you get out on your own, all of a sudden you need money. And it was just the realization that, okay, what am I going to do, you know, in life? And so I ended up in Austria at a big show in Austria, and it was a big deal. And after the Austria, it was New Year's Eve, and after the New Year's Eve live show, there was this party. And I remember this one moment where it was really exciting. They asked us to play. There was like 1,000 people at this big ball in Vienna, at the mayor's ball. It was like literally walking into Cinderella's ball. That's what it looked like. They had the Vienna State Opera, Symphony playing, and the ballet were there. It was amazing. But anyway, they asked us if we'd play. I remember coming off the stage, the people went crazy for it. And I thought, wow, this could really work. And then we had at the airport at 4. So there wasn't a lot of sleep that night. But anyway, I just remember that one moment where it's like I got off stage and I thought this was in a foreign territory where we didn't have friends and family that are going to cheer anyway. It was strangers and they loved it. And that's when it kind of kicked in for me that, you know, this it was what I wanted to do, and I think this could work.
And then how did your paths cross? Danelle, did you just take a page out of your father's book, having married a Cape Breton girl, and thought you'd try to do the same?
Well, it was sort of like that. Pretty good little story, but I'll just preface it with, I was practicing a lot as a little lad, and I remember on the road, we were in the truck going to feed cattle in the wintertime, and we were driving down the dirt road. I know the spot exactly, and my dad said, Danelle, I know you're practicing a lot, and I just want you to know that if you get nothing else out of your practicing or your music, then the right girl hearing you play for a half hour. He said, if you get nothing, just to have that moment, to have the right girl hear you play, all the practicing will be worth it. I was in Germany on that trip. My sister had a cassette tape of a girl named Natalie McMaster. There was no picture on the cover of the, it was just a copied tape, you know, she had taped it off of something. Really loved the music. And I decided when I got back from Germany, which was in October, I was going to miss the first semester of school. I decided as soon as I got home, I needed to go for a trip by myself. So I knew this Natalie girl was in Nova Scotia. So I drove to Nova Scotia, found out she was at Teachers College in Truro. And I phoned her up. And I said, you don't know me. Well, you tell what I said. I forget.
Hi there. My name's Danelle Leahy. You probably don't know me, but I'm a fiddler from Ontario. And I said, I do know you. I have your cassette tape at home. And he said, I'm in town tonight. I was wondering if I could take you out to dinner. And we went to dinner and we dated for 2 years, broke up for 10, and then we got married. Ta-da! Did you catch all that?
Wow. I guess there is quite a story there, the 10 years of being apart, but we don't have to go down that road entirely.
Yeah.
I just was young people with careers and music and distance and traveling all over the place, and it just wasn't our time.
So, I mean, like during those 10 years, that's when, you know, both of your careers really, really took off, and what then led to coming back together and trying to do your music collaboratively and raise a family together.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Those 10 years were when we did our most of our work, our biggest touring days for sure. And yeah, I mean, it was a valuable time, even though I thank God we got a second chance, you know. But it was a valuable time. And what it did allow us to do was when we got married, we had established ourselves. And now it's just incredible how it is just keeps growing and growing.
Was it both of you guys sort of wanting to reach back out to the other person at the same time? Or was there one that sort of drove the idea of giving it a second chance?
You know,
common question.
Yeah. Back to the, I just wanted to touch on something. Oh yes, the time apart was really important because we established ourselves, of course, but as individuals and we were, you know, that's important to be able to stand on your own two feet. You know, came back, you know, Natalie was successful and I was successful, and it was wonderful to both be independently successful. I guess, you know, the confidence to. Well, you know what? We never really ran across each other in 10 years. Maybe once in Toronto at some festival.
Yeah.
You think that, you know, two fiddle players playing festivals all over the place, we would be at the same festival. But I think there was once.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Owen Sound.
It was Owen Sound.
Owen Sound.
Well, wasn't there Montreal too?
No, I don't remember that.
See,
I didn't notice you back then. You must have noticed me. But I just forget. I think I called you. I think maybe I was...
You're in the area.
I was in Halifax or something.
Yeah.
Doing something.
You were a couple hours from where I lived. Yeah. It was Easter time, so you figured I'd be home.
Yeah. So yeah. I called you and
we got together again. And never broke up.
Yeah, you are.
Wow, what a special story. I think about, you know, your faith and just how like Adam, you know, he had that purpose, that place, those parameters kind of instilled before Eve came on the scene, and even sort of how, you know, you both establish yourself, careers, kind of having that purpose maybe more driven out before the other person came into the picture in that marriage way. Just going off of that, when it came to settle down as a family, What sort of made you want to go and have a base on the farm? Like, did you ever entertain just like touring all the time as you had success doing?
I never did. The farm is a wonderful contrast, a wonderful place. It's just such a great thing. The farm for us, I have brothers and sisters, and I have specifically two brothers that live close to me, and we kind of farmed together, and my father was alive, of course, back then. And so there was always room for us to, the farm never held me back from playing music or traveling. And if it was such that the opportunities that I wanted to take were 365 days of the year, I could just go. I had brothers and a father, and you could just get the work done. And so it was wonderful for me to be able to come and go. And, you know, farming became my golf and became my passion. And I remember one time, it was really funny. I remember one time, I think it was a Juno Awards or something, and we had won, I'd won something, and on the big stage and the big whatever. And the next day I was out in the barn in my rubber boots, and I was laughing. I was thinking, you know, if people could see me now, yesterday it was the glitz and the glamour and here I am out in the real world. And I loved it. I just love that. So,
it does keep you really knowing that you're not above anything.
Exactly.
I can remember being honored one night. Remember in New York that I guess mom went with me.
Yeah.
But
I remember that.
The Maple Leaf Award in New York. This big ceremony with like a special videotape that I didn't know about or recording, and they showed like my whole life in front of me, and there was like 500 people there having dinner honoring in New York. I'm like, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't. Why are they doing this? But anyway, I mean, it was connected to a fundraiser as well and stuff, but I came back the next day and I had like, you know, toddlers just running around me and the grossness on the floor and wiping snot off their faces. And like whatever I was doing the next day was like the exact opposite. I was like, you know, sheets that were stained with, you know, somebody's pull up would have leaked, and I'm cleaning and off the floor and cleaning the bed. I was just like, whoa, this is like so opposite. And it lets you know that, you know, you're not above anything. Just because you are praised, you're still a servant, you know, and you should be.
And was that something that, like, I mean, you saw a model to you and you just wanted to follow that in terms of the way that you would conduct yourself, like in wanting to have that balance?
Oh, for sure. Like, I love the farm and I never grew up with it. My parents did. So maybe I have farm inclinations in my bloodstream or something, but certainly it was an awakening. Danelle used to, and still does, he takes his opportunities to have fun with my ignorance of, you know, and many's the time he's said, oh, watch out for the white cow, you know, and of course I turn around, there's a white cow behind me and I'm freaking out, and he knows the cow is docile, and but all those types of fun things. But no, the farm has just been excellent, and I'm so proud to be raising our kids on a farm. I just love it.
Yeah, talk to me about your kids and, you know, they're following in your footsteps of music, but just getting to work together and to live together. Is this something that they showed an interest in at a young age to follow what you guys were doing? What was the pull push in terms of them now being very competent step dancers and fiddler players themselves?
Well, I think it's kind of somewhat like when I grew up, you know, they play, they're genetically forced to play, and we've taught them to play, and we travel as a family. Natalie and I do not take off touring without them. I mean, we'd go to the odd show, but we would never leave the kids. So they have to practice and they get on the stage. And what can I say? I don't think they've never chosen to do this. Our eldest is only 15. So they just, is there a pool at the hotel, Dad? That's the big one.
Yeah, that's the big one.
And it's great. We homeschool, so that happens on the road and on tour, and they plug themselves into our life, and I compare it
a lot to eating your vegetables. You know, we as parents, people can understand, parents try to give good things to their kids. And for us, music is absolute. We must teach music to our kids. I would go to my grave just absolutely miserable if I didn't pass music on to my kids. That is the number one goal for me, other than the common sense and morals and stuff like that, but passing on our music. So we give music to them the same way we give them good food and, you know, warm clothing and all the things that they need. We believe they need this.
And not to be professional musicians, but to have and love and...
And to feed them.
To
feed them in ways.
Music.
And, yeah, if they, you know, we can't control what their future holds, but we can provide them with music here in the home, and we know they're all musically inclined. And through their different ages, they go through ebbs and flows of, oh, I'm really into something for a while, and then the next week it's something else. You know, it could be the fiddle, you know, they get on a big fiddle practice, or they get into soccer the next week. You know, there will be those natural ebbs and flows. What they turn out to be will be up to them and whatever, you know, path that God has for them and that they hopefully find.
This is just a great foundation to give them something you want to share what you've benefited from. For someone who doesn't really know or isn't familiar with, you know, Celtic music, step dancing, fiddling, how would you boil it down to them? How would you describe what it entails and what the appeal is?
The appeal of
Celtic music.
Because, you know, it's not, you're not, we're not hearing it on the radio in the same way that
I
know hear top 40 per se, or even rock.
Yeah. Janelle and I talk about that. I'm convinced and have been convinced several times in my life, especially coming from a parental point of view, that Celtic music is extremely, as many roots music or traditional music is, it's extremely important in our world. Why is it extremely important? Because I believe that you don't have to be any kind of a way or any kind of a person to have access to it or to be allowed in it. Like a lot of the cultures of, I guess, fads and pop music, and there's pressure, there's, you know, if you get into those types of worlds, there can be pressures to appear a certain way or do it a certain way or look a certain way. And I just feel it's a type of music that is great for your being, your sense of value, your connection with the earth, with other mankind, with things that are tangible, you know. It has those qualities. So, yeah.
It's also been handed down from generation to generation. So there's a connection to the past, and as musicians who play by ear, and most Celtic people would play by ear, you can't help but be affected by, you know, the other music we hear, and that's cool too. But there's this connection to the past. This old tune is 300 years old, and my great 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 grandfather played it and taught it to his kids. And even some of the instruments are a hand-me-down tradition. So I think it's grounding, and I think it's I don't want to say it doesn't change, because it does change, but there's certainly elements of it that have always been there and always will be there.
All that being said, too, the music itself is just fun and lifey and spirited, and it promotes good environments. I guess there's some environments where you know, it's in a bar or something, but that can be fun and good, too. I'm not discrediting that. We've all had good times at the bar.
No, but it's a participatory music as well.
Multiple generations, and it's just kind of fun and lighthearted, and I mean, it can be serious too, but yeah.
Yeah, I think in my experience, seeing some in your family step dance and fiddle, it has been very generational, even in the audience that's watching it, and something that can be enjoyed, like you say, with a, you know, from a grandparent down to their grandchild, as opposed to maybe some other forms of music or even live entertainment that might attract more of a very specific audience demographic. So that's a really neat piece that I think is, you know, attracts people to it. And would you say anything more about the audience, like from what you've learned in touring and performing, and those that are big fans of yours? Like, could you profile who would be like your biggest supporters?
Well, that's a great question. I remember my family opened for Shania Twain for 176 shows for a couple of years. We were the opening act for Shania Twain, And it was interesting how that all happened, but that's a long story. But the end, the point I'm making is when people would see us perform and Shania, they would think that's not a very good mix. She's this pop country girl and we're this traditional step dancing fiddling group. And what the connect, the key was, is that her audience was 3 to 93 and our audience was 3 to 93 and it was everybody. I remember playing in at the Duke of Somerset. It was a pub in Ottawa, great pub. And I remember we'd be booked there for 3 nights. And it was mainly a university crowd. And by the third night, people were bringing their parents out. It was really cool. It was really cool. Usually the parents are dragging their kids out to something. We went in there, and from that point on, we'd be sold out every night. And you know, the fiddling in particular has crossed over into, you know, there's such fiddling cultures, the classical country. And you've met, you know, fiddle players, Natalie, from all over Sweden and
Norway
and
Finland.
Annismore.
Just in closing, I wonder if we could just get some bearing on where you guys are today with your music, and specifically interested in kind of hearing how you came together collaboratively, because you guys, as you said, you did establish yourselves as successful fiddlers, but you had very different styles. And from what I understand, the beginnings of working together from a musical standpoint, there was some obstacles to overcome. How did you manage to navigate that and to come to where you are today?
I think that over the years, yeah, certainly you're right. So I'll just acknowledge that it was tough playing together in the beginning. It's funny, when we got married, I thought, oh my gosh, this is so great. Danelle Leahy is my husband and he's such an awesome fiddler and I'm a fiddler and we're going to fiddle. And, you know, and then it was like, I think it was a good couple of years before we played any music together because he was gone one way and I was gone the other often, you know, or your tours get booked a year in advance. So we were off doing our own thing still. But when we would get together and play, it was tricky because all the tunes that we had in common, we learned differently. He learned them in Ontario in a different way, and I learned them in Cape Breton in the Cape Breton way. So to play them together at the same time, they didn't gel very well. It actually didn't sound very good. And I'm just being honest, like Danelle and I get a kick out of the fact that it actually didn't sound that good because he was covering up my nuances and I was covering up his. And they were so unique that it just kind of was a bit messy. So as the years go on, we've learned a couple of things. We've learned how to listen to one another better and to fall into each other's groove. We might say, okay, this is a tune that we're going to play more with my flavoring. So Danelle will kind of listen and kind of get into that. But then there's other pieces where like, okay, let's rip these ones wide open. Like just, you know, because Danelle's firecracker. So I kind of adjust my music to kind of blend in with how he was playing it. And then the other thing that works really well is when we learn a tune together. If we learn a tune together, then we're learning it the same way.
Or write it.
Or thirdly, writing. Yeah. If we write something, you know, we often create an arrangement that allows for our different styles to shine. Yeah. So over the years, what are we working on now? We've got recording equipment, which we never thought we'd had. Thank you very much, COVID. And we have been working, you know, doing projects here, very creative process that we went through first, writing and arranging. And now we're at the recording stages where we're recording some tracks. We should have something out in the next month to start out, you know, releasing some tracks for a new CD. And we've been working on these projects from home to allow us to keep playing music and having a reason to play other than just to keep up our chops.
That's really cool. I guess just one final question I have is, I know you've touched on some of the many accolades and accomplishments you guys have had. I mean, Natalie being named to the Order of Canada, Danelle opening for Shania Twain, your kids being on NBC's Little Big Shots. Is there any highlight of those that hasn't been mentioned so far in this conversation that you would say has been like a real something that you look back on and you're just like kind of amazed that you got to experience that?
There's lots of those really great moments and playing with this person and playing in this venue, and there's all those fancy ones. But I can say honestly, there's nothing bigger I can say for Natalie than going home to Cape Breton and playing in a little dance hall. And I've seen Natalie under the pressure of playing Carnegie Hall and under the pressure of playing at the local
West Mabu
Square Dance. And the West Mabu Square Dance is the most enjoyable and most pressure-filled thing for Natalie. playing at home.
A couple hundred people. Not very big, but the hall is packed.
And they all know the music, and they all know the nuance, and that's where you wanna shine. So
because you're playing in front of people who are experts, really, right? Whereas anywhere else in the world, no one knows what it's supposed to sound like. So anything you do is great.
Yeah. So I mean, as far as something that stands out to me, I mean, there's so many wonderful times, but.
When you met Wayne Gretzky, that must have stood out.
Oh, meeting people and things, but I'm thinking of a performance, you know, is there a performance?
What about those Shania shows? There'd be such a massive crowd.
Yeah, they all had their thing. You know, the big playing in front of the massive crowd has its thing, but playing in the little intimate 200-seat theater where everyone can hear you sweat, you know, or those clubs. You know, there was one in particular for me, back in those days when we didn't have any gigs, and I decided I'd, you know, play at a bar. I went to a bar in Toronto, McVeigh's Windsor House, and I went to them and said, I'm a fiddle player, and I know you won't hire me, but I'll play for free on a Monday night if you'll just let me play.
Prove myself.
Yeah. And they said, okay, sure. There'll be nobody here anyway, so that's fine. So I was able to invite a number of people, and I got the place packed and had a great night. And from that one little night, I booked myself, that bar booked me for 4 nights, and two other bars in Toronto booked me for 4 nights. And that sort of started my thing here. So then I ended up recording and traveling and touring and doing all the thing. And I said to myself one night, you know, I could have done that in any city in the world. Mm-hmm. And so I said, why not try New York? So I did the same thing in New York. I phoned up a bar called Patty Riley's, introduced myself as a fiddle player from Canada, and I want to come down and play. And he said, you're from Canada? He said, I have a band setting up right now from Canada. They're called the Mahones. And I said, go talk to the singer. I think his name was Fintan McConnell. He used to come to hear me play. He used to come and hear me play in Toronto. I said, go and ask him about me. He said, okay, I will. So about 4 minutes later, I hear the phone being picked up, and he says, are you available March 2nd? So I ended up going to New York with my little entourage and got 6 bookings out of that night in New York.
Wow.
And it started in the States for me.
That's incredible. That initiative and those humble beginnings. That's awesome. Natalie, what about you? Is there a career highlight looking back on this so far?
There was tons of fun things. The thing that I got a kick out of was doing things that weren't necessarily directly related to the fiddle. So like hosting award shows. I remember I did with Sean Majumder. We hosted one of the ECMAs. And then I hosted Parliament Hill Canada Day celebration. And those were really fun. Doing Sesame Street. That was fun. It was like acting. Over in Europe, I remember doing in England, there was this famous kid show. Maybe it was in Scotland. It was called Blue Peter. Well, if you mention that over there, it's like Mr. Dress Up in Canada, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
And that was, or Blue Peter, that's the way they said it. And it was, you know, those types of things. I can remember being in a dressing room with Michael McDonald from oh my goodness. I was going to say the Bee Gees from the Doobie Brothers, and meeting him for the first time and running through Danny Boy because we were going to perform it together. And that was a real special moment for me because I grew up listening to his music. I don't want to sit here and name a bunch of, anyway, you're asking, so I'll tell you, but playing at the Hollywood Bowl was an incredible highlight.
California, LA.
Yeah. Okay. Played down there a few times and of course Carnegie Hall and heading down to Antarctica with the Chieftains for the Millennium was a highlight. I was pretty nervous on that boat. Icebergs everywhere, massive icebergs. I'm like, oh my God, the Titanic is all I could think of. Anyway, we made it back.
Danelle Leahy, Natalie McMaster, great to learn about your lives and get a bit of an insight on what it takes to be a fiddler, all that goes into that. Lots of hard work and lots of reward. Really appreciate this.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, David.
that was great. First time having multiple guests on the show at once, and I think we're going to have to do it more often. I mean, Natalie and Danelle, they're really fed off of each other. You can tell they're a great couple. So humble, too. Love how the farming and the big family keeps them grounded, and I think it really does come back to their faith. It was a good introduction to their style of music, too. If you haven't taken in any of their fiddling before, I have done live, and it is incredible. It's no substitute to not get that way, but you can head to natalieanddanelle.com. And you won't be disappointed. That's Danelle with two N's and two L's. We'll also be linking back everything at the show notes at davidmanmedia.com. All right, next week on Culture at a Crossroads, we're going to be ending up this season two. That'll bring us to 40 episodes of the podcast, which is incredible. Thank you for your support. We are wrapping up the season with a big guest. From fiddling to federal politics. Yes, the guy should be no stranger to you. Up until the end of 2019, he was the Conservative Party leader and the leader of the opposition. Andrew Scheer joins me on the show to unpack the 2019 federal election. If you remember, he did win the popular vote. He remains a member of Parliament for Regina Capel, and he's got lots of thoughts on the state of both Canada and Conservative politics. Of course, the focus of our conversation will be on Mr. Scheer's faith. He's a devout Catholic who considers politics his calling.
When it touches on core values, core principles, there's nothing you can say to me that is going to make me worried about that, because I would be held accountable by someone even more powerful than, you know, the whip of a political party or the chief of staff in the prime minister's office.
Andrew Scheer will take a trip down memory lane to share how his faith became so personal, plus forever overcoming the odds. Scheer got elected MP at 25. He was the youngest Speaker of the House of Commons in Canadian history at 32, and he wasn't expected to be leader of the Conservatives either. Andrew Scheer is next week. You don't want to miss that. In the meantime, you can follow us on the socials. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Culture at a Crossroads. We also have a newsletter that goes out every week. You can subscribe on the website at A Closer Look for that. Until next week, I'm David Mann. Thanks for listening to Culture at a Crossroads.